You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and I am recording this in the afternoon, which is weird. I usually do these at ungodly hours, but Sunday afternoon, April 26th, 2026, and Christ is risen, I say to everybody. We're going to deal with another theological topic today, but it's really political theology. But before we get into that, I want to thank my listeners and others I've gotten from other platforms, Pete's listeners, etc., for their generosity over the last year or so. It's helped me a tremendous amount, and I would also ask you to subscribe to my Patreon. I just uploaded a lengthy revisionist article on the Vietnam War, and buy my book, if that's at all possible, and leave a review on Amazon. The latest book, that is to say, on the Russo-Ukrainian War 2022-2025. The reviews have been pretty good so far. I don't expect perfection, but, you know, but I poured my heart and soul into that book like no other. So, today, we're going to deal with a topic. We're going to deal with the Optima Hermitage and the political theology, specifically. And that's there's not a whole lot out there on that. There's tons on the spirituality there. It was a very, very famous monastery, especially in the 19th century. And what I had to do is glean the political stuff from the stuff that they, you know, on the end times and things like that. And had to go through the Russian literature there. But they were very interesting in that regard. And, you know, they were almost shut down. Well, they were shut down by the Petrine state in the 18th century for a while. So they're not going to be just, you know, they're going to have a certain understanding of the state different from what you might expect. But still, the culture there was oriented towards the outside world, despite the fact that they were cut off from it. But their fame brought them connections that they, you know, that helped them, and a diverse, a wide range of literary figures who went there. Not to mention translation and publishing activities. And then of course it's only recently been revived. Well, recently, it began in 1987, but it's a slow but sure process. And it's been essentially a series of deaths and resurrections for Optina. And as many of you know, Orthodox people know, the core of everything concerning this hermitage was eldership. Now, this is not the only place that had it. It is of ancient origin. But Optina brought it to a tremendous height in the late 1820s. And this is really what brought it fame in the 19th century. Now, monks despise fame. Unfortunately, in Optina, you know, you had huge crowds showing up there, which led to the creation of an actual, I mean, it's called a hermitage, Pustin, but it's you know, it functions like a, you know, normal monastery, but in certain parts of it, pilgrims are not allowed. And that's where the actual hermit cells can be found, even today. But those who came both as monks and as well as visitors, they came for the possibility of speaking with one of the elders. Eldership is a one-to-one relationship. It's usually with a monk. You know, elderly, someone who's been around a very long time, who has a tremendous amount of experience. And someone who eventually comes to know you personally. You see, the concept of the final judgment is that all of your excuses, all the ways that you use language or whatever else you do to excuse your sins are laid bare. And that's what's supposed to happen here. Everything's supposed to be laid bare. In hope that when that judgment comes, you won't have anything to worry about. And for whatever reason, Optina had a laundry list of extremely talented elders who even people who weren't necessarily believers came out after conversations with them that these are extraordinary men. Now, it's something that you're called to. No one wants to be an elder. It's someone who's been around a while. The difficult struggle within the monastic path attains a certain level of dispassion and purity of heart. They were living theology. They weren't necessarily theologians in the Western sense, but they were floods of theology. And quite often, even if they didn't know you very well, they knew that you were hiding things. They were better than any psychologist that the West has ever produced. And at least relative to the person that they're dealing with, they knew God's will for them. Hence, they could guide those they're speaking to towards their salvation. They were not your friend. You know, they were your father in the best sense of the word. The Apostle Paul even talks about discernment in 1 Corinthians. That's the beginning of this concept. An elder is a man who guides us towards salvation, the kingdom of heaven. But going in there and, you know, if you wanted to go in there and lied or made excuses for your sins and everything else, it wasn't going to turn out well. They were going to know. And there's pages and pages and pages of people who have repeated this, because some things are just simply embarrassing, they just don't want to talk about. So an elder is a very experienced monastic who can guide others. And for a couple of centuries, someone would emerge from the elder's cell, a transformed individual. But they never saw the world the same way again. And that's why they attracted, you know, Gogol and Dostoevsky, even Lev Tolstoy. Not really a believer. But, of course, we're dealing with, for the most part, with the 19th century. And, as you know, there's a tremendous struggle in the church in the 19th century. They're barely recovering from the 18th and the Masonic battles with the Orthodox Church they had to fight. And so the entire ideological core of the church was needed to be restated, and the monastic, especially the Optino, was one of the ways it was restated. An eldership, the man who existed entirely for the other, a man whose entire life was sacrificed for his spiritual children. This was a tremendous form of love. And even more than that, the elder was responsible for their later behavior. They were responsible for their salvation. It's like Moses carrying the entire nation of Israel. Self-forgetfulness, as we might call it. An extraordinary level of empathy. It's way beyond simple compassion, and or even empathy for that matter. The elder was not a normal person. He was outside of the world in almost all respects. But his psychology had developed to a tremendous degree. And, you know, by the time it was shut down by the Soviets, you know, they had heard it all. So there really was no point in hiding anything. But this is what made it famous. It was seen as the, you know, part of the revival of Russian Orthodoxy in the 19th century. When I say, you know, the place was crowded, I mean, you know, tens of thousands a day, maybe more. I mean, Sarov was the same way. And within the walls of the community, you had a whole community of laymen too, both married and single. So they could go to the services and everything else. This was it started out as a hermitage, did not end up that way. And this is what they were called to. Yes, they were connected with the outside world. They had no choice. Or let me put it this way, the outside world was connected with them. They weren't just worried about what was happening in their monastery. But, you know, politics tends to happen to you if you ignore it. And certainly politics, international relations, happen to them. Now, Optino kept a chronicle. It was actually on their website, although some of them have been or are missing. The 19th and early 20th century, and the John the Baptist skete at the Hermitage. And that's actually pretty useful. But to deal with the politics of this, it's a tremendous amount of work, because there's really not a whole lot specifically just on that. But it even says, what's important to record here is outstanding events in the church and the political life of Russia. It was compiled with the blessing of the elders, and to a certain extent reflected the views of the entire brotherhood. The abbot and the elder were not the same person, generally speaking. Abbot was an executive position. The elder was not. There is no way you could be an abbot of a monastery and be an elder, especially in an Orthodox country. When I first converted, I thought they were one and the same. They're not. You could call someone your spiritual father. That doesn't necessarily mean they're your elder. But because of all this, they did have contacts with the imperial family. They were visited on a relatively regular basis by members of royalty throughout. And this is one of the things that kept them loyal to Orthodoxy. And it set a tremendous example. You see, it's in the correspondence with the Grand Duke Konstantinovich. The Archimandrite Isaac calls him immensely happy, because he was honored to contemplate the most august person, such a high religiosity, and Christ's imitative humility. This is what he saw in the Grand Duke. No one left there the same. Many people converted who were not Orthodox. Many people converted who simply went there and spoke to people. Now, I probably don't have to say this, but of course they're royalists. But it was within the context of the 19th century world, not necessarily Old Rus. Nicholas I, they held in extraordinary regard. The murder of Alexander II left a heavy impression on the monastery, especially the elder Ambrose. He wrote in a letter in 1881, "The Lord allowed Alexander II to die a martyr's death, but he is strong to give help from above to Alexander III, the kind of the villains infected with the spirit of Antichrist." In other words, it makes sense that someone like Alexander III, strong and totally incorruptible, would follow someone who was murdered by leftists. So of them all, probably Alexander III is one of the greatest czars of all time for that reason. Also, probably in the best regarded of them, I probably should say Alexander III and Nicholas I. And they took at least some credit. You know, the church had always been about centralizing political power in Russia. And Alexander III, coming out of this murder, you know, he realized known for his, you know, they say that he reversed his father's reforms. No. He simply brought them back to their proper limit. Alexander's reforms were extraordinary and even more far-reaching than Alexander II. So they saw in Alexander III both deep religion as well as a strong political will. And the monks, this is their ideal ruler. And they met him several times. Here's one of the things that they said. This is in their chronicle of the Optina monastery. "The devotion of the Orthodox Russian people to their Tsar is not at all the same as the devotion of Western peoples to their sovereigns. According to modern Western concepts, the sovereign is nothing more than a representative of his people, and the Western peoples love their representatives and willingly obey when they faithfully fulfill this purpose. This is self-serving. This is selfish love. It is not at all the same here in Russia. Our Tsar is representative of the will of God, not necessarily the will of the people. His will is sacral to us, like the will of the anointed of God. We love him because we love God." And, you know, I hate to tell him, but royalism in 1881 and beyond that in Western Europe was collapsing. And of course, it didn't have much longer to go. The argument is that it's simply utilitarian. It's not to say that the Russian monarchy wasn't representative. It most certainly was. But they were bound by laws, and some of those laws were canon laws. The first time they really got excessively, but they got very deeply political. And when I say political, I don't mean elections and voting. I'm talking about issues of justice. It's 1848, for obvious reasons. And they were very firm on the side of the legitimate rulers. For them, revolutions in Christian states seemed bizarrely unnatural. But when I say that the politics was politics happened to them, politics was dumped on them, well, it's true. Wars waged by Russia led to the partial transformation of it into a hospital. You had many of the novices in Optina, as well as some of the laymen serving in the army. Russo-Turkish, Russo-Japanese, First World War. The monks also saw in the Crimean War, as they were properly, you know, as they should, a religious class as well as a political one. And made a big deal of the fact that the West was now allied with Turkey. The struggle of the cross with Lucifer and the crescent moon allied with him. With indignation, former Optina monk Anthony Medvedev, in a war that should never have been, because Westerners were in alliance with Turkey against Russia, and frankly, they'd be in alliance with anyone against Russia. This was, with the notable exception, you know, there was one country that did not join that alliance, and that was Prussia. But they were simply neutral. They weren't necessarily pro-Russia. They also were vehemently on the side of the Orthodox Slavs as they began to rebel against the Turks, too. They sent quite a bit of money there. About 40 wounded soldiers passed through the monastery hospital during the Russo-Turkish Wars, 1877-1878. That was quite an expensive operation. They donated many. They donated money to units of the army. Hero monk Clement Zidrigal got hold of the prayers of the granting of victory over the enemies of God. In fact, there's a canon to that. And in fact, that was used in their Russian media. Same thing for the Russo-Japanese War. Lupino collected church items for a donation for the needs of the front, as well as just their needs beyond that. Father Barsanuphius was a former colonel. Realizing that this was a terrible struggle, and he said, "I believe together with all Orthodox Russian people that the incomprehensible divine power of the honest and life-giving cross will win and crush the dark powers of the deep serpent dragon that flaunts on Japanese banners." Well, we all know it's the British, not so much the Japanese as such. The Japanese, you know, are a seafaring people to a great extent, like the British, and they were used by them to attack Russia from the east, and of course we've dealt with that many other times on this show. World War I was a completely different story. No one expected the carnage. They had a substantial hospital. They expanded 25 beds for the wounded, 10 beds for the full support, for that's just for recovering or crippled soldiers, 50 beds for refugees, and 50 for evacuated monastics. That's not much, but that's what they, that's the room that they had. They were patriots. Whether or not they believed that the war should have happened at all, or that Russia should have mobilized, is irrelevant. They were in it. They also mentioned at the end of 1916 the Jewish problem, because the decline of trade, in the sense that it was going into Jewish hands. They said non-Russian hands. Elsewhere, they said Jewish hands. And we know that because they would say, well, beyond that, the inappropriate proliferation of theaters and other spectacles and amusements connected to leftist newspapers, which, of course, is what the Jewish merchant class was into. It's rare you're going to find a hermitage, a desert monastery that has this level of influence. Now, overwhelmingly, it's spiritual. But my background, of course, is in political philosophy and in history, obviously. But again, I have to glean this from a lot of other things. We talked about the Decembrists a few weeks ago, and they were loathed by the monks in Optino. Now, there's a book called Notes of the Optino Monks, compiled by Sergei Nihilus. And we read, the terrible December days of 1825, prepared by the spiritual wavering of the color of Russian education, which rushed as in the past, shaken by the wind, from one extreme to another, from the charm of demonic distorted mysticism and the charm of material false teachings, betraying in both cases the faith and loyalty of their fathers, the builders of our royal motherland. There's some years, like 1861, the chronicle is missing, or, you know, unreadable for some reason. They were anti-serfdom, and that's, which is, you know, the church also was in general. Abbot Theodosius Pope of in the 1850s. He had, as a novice, he had prayed for the God to inspire the emperor to release peasants from the landowners. This isn't a time to get into, you know, the serfdom was not slavery by any means. But they also were not free. They were tied to the land, which is really what peasants cared about. And remember, you're not talking about peasants, you're talking about communities of peasants. You're talking about communes. So the minute anyone starts talking about, you know, as if they're going to one peasant after another signing contracts is ridiculous. It's the commune as a whole. Memoirs, we do find on the day of the abolition of serfdom. We read there in the words of a novice, the Russian people understand the great revolution that begins in Russia. I don't think revolution was the best word, but it just means a great change. And of course, you did have labor, but they were always free on monastic grounds. Now, on the other hand, they also believed that, you know, freedom also has to be freedom for something. There's no such thing as abstract freedom. You're free to do what? You're free to become what? And because it's so easy to downslide, that freedom ends up often being a very bad thing. They took note of the problems in 1905, 1906. They were worried about the concept of freedom of religion in the Masonic sense of the term in the early 20th century. One of the chroniclers was a monk, Sanofi, Plekhanov, and that was rejected. Because if there is a full freedom of religion, essentially another word for that is indifferentism. Another chronicler, which actually was a Cossack monk, Ivan Poveloy, saw trends deeply hostile to the church. You didn't have a lot of attention paid to the Duma. Well, they knew what was going on. The dissolution of the Second Convocation, 1907, that was a different story. But a lot of their concern, which made sense relative to the Decembrists, for example, was this poison of Western influence, including things like utilitarianism. You know, even something good, if it brought Russia closer to the West, became a problem. You know, Starchesvo, the eldership, hezekism, these are the opposite of a revolution. In fact, what they do is bring the person to participate in the will of God. God's energies. Now, the founder of this revival, one of the people who made several monasteries famous, was Paisios Filatovsky, a great saint. Several of whose Russian disciples spread the word from Romania into Russia. He also translated the Philokalia. And with the help of Metropolitan Gabriel of St. Petersburg, that was published in 1793, which was huge for Russians. One of the big scholars, you probably come across him in Seraphim Rowe's autobiography, Ivan Kontsievich. He makes a very similar claim that the opposite of revolution is eldership, but he also connects with the gift of prophecy. Clairvoyance, foreseeing the future. And remember, they're dealing with people. You couldn't have a close personal relationship with the hundreds of thousands that showed up on a regular basis. I mean, it comes down to, ultimately, the knowledge of the will of God relative to the individual. So you're dealing with the energies of God, the Holy Spirit. And because Russia was changing, and mostly in a negative direction, culturally speaking, you had, you know, the church and the monarchies were doing everything they could to fight it. Alexander I, as you know, had done quite a bit of damage, not realizing he was, and of course he tried to make up for it. There's a future, a new martyr, Yevgeny Posilanin. He makes the political connection this way. He says, "The business of saving souls is a difficult one. The unceasing struggle with self, that is, struggle with the spirit, with the nature infected with original sin, and continuous watch over the self, necessary for success in this struggle. They're not yet enough. A vast knowledge of human nature and its relations with the external world, the spiritual benefit and harm which may be derived from contact with the world, that the way in which grace is obtained is also needed. To aid the soul in its exercises, to preserve its balance, continuous guidance is needed. Such guidance makes uninterrupted progress towards perfection possible. But the spiritual fluctuation and vicissitudes common to people who have no God. There is needed someone who knows the soul, its dispositions, abilities, its sins, its tendencies. A person with spiritual experience and wisdom, encouraging in times of laziness and sadness and restraining it in times of immoderate elation. Someone who knows how to humble pride, foresee danger, and treat sin with penance. Quick and safe is the way the man who has subjected himself to such guidance. As he practices then the great virtues, obedience and humility right away. Revelation of thoughts. So the condition, which is the sine qua non of Sarcheva, the powerful means of progress. Father Clement Sederholm wrote, who was connected to the monastery, wrote in 1875, "The path of guidance by an elder has been recognized throughout all ages of Christianity and by all great desert dwellers, fathers and teachers of the church, being the most reliable and surest of all that are known to the Church of Christ. Eldership blossomed in the ancient Egyptian and Palestinian communities, afterwards planted on Athos, and from the east brought to Russia. But in the last centuries, and due to the general decline of faith and asceticism, has gradually fallen into neglect, so that many have even begun to reject it. In the times of St. Nilaswara, the way of eldership was already scorned by many. And by the end of the past century," he means the 18th century, "it has become almost entirely unknown. For the restoration of this form of monastic life, which is founded on the teaching of the fathers," which was done by the famous and great Archimandrite of Moldovian monasteries, Paisios Velichovsky, "with great labor he gathered together on Athos and translated from Greek into Slavic the works of the great ascetic writers, who set forth a patristic teaching of monastic life in general and the spiritual relationship of the elder to others in particular. One of the disciples of the Archimandrite Paisios, Shkuma Monk Theodore, who lived in Moldova for almost 20 years, transmitted his ideas to the hero Shkuma Monk Father Leonard, and through him and his disciple, the elder hero Shkuma Monk Makarios, and it was planted at Optino. A lot of people don't realize, and I've stressed this so many times in writings, the damage done by Peter the Great and his successors. That a lot of this stuff was lost. A lot of this stuff was disappearing. And we'll talk about the persecution of Optina by the Petrine state. Now, Optina had been around quite a bit before in the 19th century, obviously, in the 18th century. But, you know, great abbots, you know, like Father Moses, they may have had the ability to be elders, but they couldn't. Combining the duties of the abbot and elder in one person was, maybe it was possible in ancient times, but absolutely impossible. And they're talking about the 19th century, today. So when Father Leonard settled in Optina, Father Moses, knowing and taking advantage of his experience and spiritual life, entrusted all the brothers who live in the monastery to his guidance, well as to all others who would come to live there. It always reminds me of St. John Maximovich, who really didn't want to be a bishop. There's too much administration, and I fully understand this. Administration, bureaucracy, is at best a necessary evil. And it takes away from your prayer rule, it takes away from your rule in general. But from that time onward, the entire order of monastic life there, it changed. Without counsel and blessing of the elder, nothing of importance was done. Every day, especially in the evening, brotherhood came to his cell, the elder's cell, with their spiritual needs. Each one hastened to reveal before the elder how he had transgressed. I mean, this was done one by one, of course, during the course of the day, in any way. Resolution of problems that had arisen, consolation for something. The constant battle with the passions. And even when he was exhausted and tired and couldn't do it anymore, he received everybody. And this was, universal there. With devotion. Now, I don't want to just say that this is just a matter of experience. I personally know when someone's lying to me, generally speaking. I ask a couple of questions and they really can't answer them well. Okay, you're hiding something. No, but this was more than that. Grace had a role to play because so many had come out of there. And this is simply just firsthand, people talking about this at the time. He didn't know me, and yet he knew all my problems. And it wasn't just monks either, people from all walks of life, generals, peasants, as I said, poor to the thousands. Other great monasteries were sending people there. Valence, Sarov, Glinsk, Kiev, whatever. People like Theophan the Recluse, Ranchanov, Innocent of Kherson, Fedorov of Kiev, Fedorov of Moscow. So much of Russian spirituality revolved around Optinov for a while. Optinov was the antithesis of the Westernism of the 19th century. And, of course, in the Soviet period, you had underground elders as well. 14 Starci, elders, have been glorified as saints. I think the most recent was St. Nektary, who died in exile from the Sovietized monastery in 1928. After the first two great Starci, Lev and Makarios, the most famous and influential was Makarios' disciple Ambrose Grenko, and Lev's disciples included Ignatius Brianchaninov. They understood. They use the word indifferentism a lot, and they connected it with the West, and that makes a lot of sense. Remember, the Judaizing heresy never quite went away. And I don't want to call it ecumenism. That's too cliche at this point. But if you remember my lecture on Alexander the First and the Bible Society and how the church almost fell for his nonsense, another term for this is religious freedom in the Masonic sense of the term. Let me clarify this. In 1850, St. Ambrose of Optina, probably the most famous of them all, wrote this. Now, many educated people bear only the name Orthodox, but in actual fact completely adhere to the morals and customs of foreign lands and foreign beliefs. Without any torment of conscience, they violate the regulations of the Orthodox Church concerning fasts. They gather together in balls and dances in the eves of great feasts of the Lord, when the Orthodox should be in church and prayerful vigil. This would be excusable if such gatherings took place on the eves of ordinary days, but not on feasts, especially great feasts. are not such acts indeed clearly inspired by our enemies, the destroyer of our souls, contrary to the commandment of God, which said, carry out your ordinary affairs for 6 days, but in the seventh, the festal day, it must be devoted to God in pious service. How have they come to behave this way? Is it not for no other reason than an indiscriminate communion with believers of other faiths? To refresh your memory, I talked about Alexander I, the rise of Alexander Golitsyn and the so-called Bible Society. He started this trend in, the church was just barely getting its act together after it was almost, a third of it was destroyed in the 18th century by the Masonic ruling class of one form or another, especially the Germans. He was indifferent to the difference of the dogmas in Christianity. They saw them all as equal. And he thought mysticism, and I put that in big quotes, was the way to get around all of that. And he really loved the Protestant individualists and Masons. The fashionable goals he pursued, the unification of all faith and universal Christianity, as he said. And he thought that the kingdom of God on earth can be established that way, which is straight out of Freemasonry. And he became the procurator of the Holy Synod. But Golitsyn said that those who follow his path, they have to show an external loyalty to the Orthodox Church. He called it a shell. He said we must outwardly belong to one of the Christian churches until we have one pastor, one form, one flock. Let's respect the appearance, internally perfecting ourselves with the Holy Spirit. Well, towards what, of course, is a big question. A tremendous pompous verbiage on his part. And his knowledge of theology was minimal. But he had become part of the Masonic and Judaizing struggle, calling it mystic. And it was, a secular movement. It wouldn't surprise you to know, and there was a lot of talk that Golitsyn was a homosexual, was a fag. That wouldn't surprise me at all. His views were both immature and chaotic, but it doesn't imply a lack of an agenda. He couldn't deal with dissent very much. And so much of what Optina was fought against, and one of the reasons they became the central institution against this, was the rise of Freemasonry, and this began. I shouldn't even say began, but it reached a tremendous level with Golitsyn becoming head of the Synod under Alexander. The Freemason D.P. Runich, who knew him very well, talked about Golitsyn. He said, surrounded by Orthodox monks, priests, bishops, and English, Lutheran, Protestant, Methodists, imbued with the spirit of biblical and other foreign Christian societies, the Minister of Spiritual Affairs and Public Education ingeniously believed it possible to reconcile all these disagreements, at the same time subordinate philosophy to religion. That was a condition of the church at the time. Saying that you want to subordinate philosophy to religion means that he thought the official ideology of Alexander's Russia would be based on Freemasonry. This was his program of spiritual education. You notice how he called him he was a minister of spiritual affairs and public education under Alexander before he became procurator of the Synod. That he was deeply imbued by Rosicrucian Freemasonry in particular. The concept was, at least according to them, the unification of faith, culture, and politics with the goal of building a single Christian republic. A kingdom of freedom and justice. Well, a republic isn't a kingdom by definition. His passions made him into a revolutionary. But of course, he could never use his blatant rhetoric. Here's what St. Ignatius Brenchaninov wrote, again, the disciple of the Optina elder Lev. You say heretics or Christians just the same. Where'd you get that from? He's obviously responding to a letter. Perhaps someone or other calling himself a Christian while knowing nothing of Christ may in his extreme ignorance decide to acknowledge himself as the same kind of Christian as heretics and fail to distinguish the holy Christian faith from those offspring of the curse of blasphemous heresies. But otherwise, however, do true Christians reason about this? The whole multitude of saints have received the martyr's crown, prefer the most cruel and prolonged torture as prison exile, rather than agree to take part with heretics and their blasphemous teachings. This ecumenical church has always recognized heresy the universal church, the ecumenical church in the real sense, the universal church has always recognized heresy as a mortal sin, always recognized that man infected with it is spiritually dead, a stranger to grace and salvation, in communion with the devil and the devil's damnation. Heresy is a sin of the mind. It is more diabolical than a normal human sin. It's the devil's offspring, his invention. It's an impiety, near idol worship. Every heresy contains in itself a blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, whether against the dogma or action of the Holy Spirit. They became increasingly pessimistic about the future of Russia. Even after the Decembrists were defeated, you know, Decembrists were high level Masons, if not all of them. Saint Parsinufius of Optina prophesied the following: the persecution and torment of the first Christians may be repeated. Hell has been destroyed, but not annihilated. The time will come when it will make itself known. All monasteries will be destroyed, and Christians in power will be overthrown. This time is not far off. Mark these words of mine. You will live to see these times. The time will come when Optina will have a hard time, and maybe this is for the best. Well, he certainly saw something, and he was certainly correct. And he instructed his disciple, St. Nikon Belyaev. He said, we will be gone, but you will be a participant and a contemporary of all these horrors. You will live to see these terrible times. Parsinufius continues, we will live to see terrible times. The grace of God will protect us. Christianity will be hated everywhere. It's a yoke for them. It prevents them from living freely, from freely committing sins. The newest generation is decaying, degenerating. They wish to live without God. Well, the fruits of such a life are obvious. The Antichrist is clearly coming into the world, but the world certainly doesn't recognize this. From here, from the monastery, the devil's snares are more clearly visible. In the last days, churches will be destroyed, and their place, pagan temples and other such things, will be built. Monasteries will be greatly persecuted and oppressed, and true Christians will huddle in small churches. The persecution and torture of the first Christians will perhaps be repeated. All monasteries will be destroyed. Christian power overthrown. Then he says, mark my words. And he sees modern technologies, and he predicted what technology may do. It may be more harmful. He talks about the new technologies that exist is more harmful than beneficial. And he added this. He said, the whole world is under the influence of some force that takes possession of the mind, the will, and all the spiritual powers of man, an alien force, an evil force. Its source is the devil, and evil people are only the tools through which he acts. Antichrist is certainly coming into the world. These are his forerunners. Concerning this, the apostle says, he will send them a spirit of error, a deceitful spirit, for they did not receive the love of truth. Something dark, terrible is coming into the world. Man remains, as it were, defenseless. The evil force takes possession of him so much that he doesn't even realize what's happening. These men had no idea how right they were. You know, they're writing this in the 19th century. Understand what they meant by the word faith. Faith is a confirmation of the truth. Faith is when you transfer truth from the intellect to the will, you actually act on it. And that's how they viewed the one force against all of this, and that is the Orthodox state, the monarchy. Uniting all the classes and estates within a union of love and obedience to the will of God, the teaching of the church. At the same time, the church needs to be independent, and its members can follow the path of Christian salvation anywhere. Elder Ambrose says this: as for human states, they are in no way related to the heavenly hierarchy or even to the earthly one. The one true church is not limited to any state, but exists throughout the universe, having as its members true believers and true pious Christians. For God makes no difference what state a person lives in, so long as he is a true believer and pious Christian. Now, it's not to say that they were not nationalists. They most certainly were. But any nationalist who knows anything recognizes the right of other ethnicities to have their own independence, and if they're Orthodox, their own Orthodox church. If they reach a level of maturity that they need one, they should be given one. It goes back to St. Photius the Great. We're talking about the state as a... sometimes state and nation are used interchangeably. The definition of the state given by someone like Elder Ambrose differs from that of the first Optina elders like Leo and Maccadius. So for Leo, for example, the danger to Russian society is not just in Western false enlightenment and rationalism, but also, and I'm quoting here, ingrained to the point of madness, immeasurable luxury and sophistication in everything that flooded us with Western teachers, fashion, chefs, gourmets, confectioners, and their shops. So in his mind, it was what we call success, money, the bourgeois life that was bringing in the Antichrist. Elder Maccadius rejected the use of the French language, and because it was a fashionable thing for Russian nobles to speak French, especially in the north, especially in the Petersburg area. Dostoevsky made fun of it all the time. He says, "The spread of the French language has done much harm to our fatherland. Young men and women all eagerly read what is not useful, but harmful." Sergei Uvarov's predecessor, of course, Uvarov is very famous. His predecessor isn't, and that's Admiral Alexander Shishkov. Who had, the famous orthodoxy, autocracy, nationality, which is pretty much all, Westerners know about Russian nationalism, at least of the day. The goal of preserving language and customs of our ancestors, the desire to show love. The emphasis on preserving the national language of the Russian people is evident both in the views of the Optina elders and in the state ideology of Alexander's reign. In fact, it was the only point of agreement with Alexander I. But, Uvanov wasn't the first person to come up with orthodoxy, autocracy, nationality. Those three things had been used in various forms before. The letters of Elders Ambrose and Joseph from Optina contain things that are very similar to that. For faith, Tsar and Fatherland is one, for example. Metropolitan Filaret has several, too. Elder Ambrose has a modified version where he says, "For the Holy Orthodox faith, the state, the Tsar, and the dear Fatherland." This order of the motto's components, I guess, suggests that for St. Ambrose, the symbol of royal power was more significant than that of the autocrat himself, which is certainly true. Remember, Optina had not that long ago suffered from state oppression under the revolutionary Petrine regime. The Optina monks were very clear that there are certain things that pertain to the earthly and certain pertain to the heavenly that were mixed in the concept of orthodoxy, autocracy, nationality, at least in their opinion. The elders' letters contain the concepts of fatherland as our true fatherland, or, at a minimum, both of them together. Fatherland is just our nation, the state, its power, which is very important. Of course, a true fatherland is the kingdom of heaven, the life of the age to come. You know, the state for them was something, you know, they had mixed feelings about it. They also separated the concept of government and czar, which is probably a very, very good idea. Elder Ambrose says this: "It's vain and unfair of you to think that things are done only through men without their participation, without the participation of God's providence. Besides earthly authority, there's also the heavenly King, the Holy Spirit, who governs all things for our benefit. He arranges what is useful and removes what is not useful. And the two of them, as the Chalcedonian formula shows, have to work together. The earthly and the heavenly, they are distinct. The church is an integral part of the fabric of the state. But of course, it cannot be used to achieve the state's political objectives, and we see that happening in the 20th century. Again, St. Barsanuphius says this: "Our czar is representative of God's will, not the people's. His will is sacred to us, the will of God's anointed. We love him because we love God. The czar grants us glory and prosperity. We accept it from him as God's mercy. Does shame befall us? We bear all hardships and disasters with meekness and humility as a devotion. I'm sorry, as a heavenly punishment for our iniquities, and we'll never change our love and devotion to the czar. As long as they flow from our Orthodox religious convictions, from our love and devotion to God." Obviously, he was well aware that could be taken too far. What we're getting at here is something that shows up in not just in St. Ambrose's letters, but in eldership in general. Freedom. You don't have to do any of this. God does not force anyone to do anything. He provides the light, something that you know is true intellectually, has to be transferred to the will, and so you put it into action. So for Optina, the Tsar wasn't just a defender of the faith, the fatherland, but even more than that, was the one who held back, as we've been saying, the coming of the Antichrist into the world. And we you know, Optina was heavy into this, the Katon idea from the Greek restraint. Elder Ambrose developed this to a great extent. St. Philaret also, as we've spoken about many times before, contained this term. One who holds back in the sense of state power. Of course, the church is a huge part of that. Ambrose interprets the concept of the one who holds back not only in terms of earthly power, but also in the sense of the end of the world. After the murder of Alexander II, the Optina ascetic adds this. He says this. He says the apostle's words, "Hold fast," refer to the ruling power and ecclesiastical authority against which the forerunners of the Antichrist rise up to abolish and destroy it on earth. For the Antichrist, according to the explanation of the interpreters of Holy Scripture, must come during the time of anarchy on earth. Now, I've made this claim many times in the past. The left needs warfare for them to build a revolutionary idea. Vietnam in America, especially the draft, was one of the ways that they shoehorned in so many things that were totally irrelevant to that. Anarchy on Earth is necessary for their agenda. They despise peace. They despise calmness. Hossein Fillaret viewed the secularization of the state through a very different lens. For him, as Nikolai Pavlyuchenkov says, the desacralization of power in its various forms, a departure from the paradigm of Tsarist autocracy, transformation to an autocrat, into a dictator, etc., is a departure from the ancestral tradition, which in turn is a consequence, at least the loss of favor with God, the King of Kings. And of course, we're all familiar with the decay of any monarch into a tyrant. You know, the opposite of monarchy is tyranny. Like the opposite of aristocracy is oligarchy. And that comes into existence only through a lack of humility. The experience that they had under Peter and Catherine was still fresh in their minds, of all well-educated Russians. Of course, there's a Christian community without an empire or emperor. That's not the point. St. Ambrose, the absence of the Orthodox autocratic ruler, the head of state, signified the arrival of the end times. Let me quote St. Ignatius again. We're helpless to arrest this apostasy. Impotent hands, we have no power against it. Nothing more will be required than you attempt to withhold it. The spirit of the age will reveal the apostasy. Study it, if you wish to avoid it, if you wish to escape this age, the temptation of the spirits. One can suppose, too, the institution of the church, which has been tottering for so long, will fall terribly, and suddenly, indeed, no one is able to stop or prevent it. The present means to sustain the institutional church are borrowed from the elements of the world, things inimical to the church. The consequence could be only to accelerate its fall. Nevertheless, the Lord protects the elect, and their limited number will be filled. February Revolution, 1917. We know that it was greeted by the majority of clergy with enthusiasm. They supported it. They used the synodal system as the excuse. Sometimes it actually was the real reason. And with that, the synodal system collapsed and the road was open to the free development of church reform. Things that happened in ancient Rus were rebuilt. But I don't believe that the majority of even of well-educated Russian Orthodox people knew what the February Revolution really was. I mean, you know, you could use the cop-out of Romans 13. But there was a problem here. And when Tsar Nicholas did not abdicate, he was forced out. But they didn't know that. They didn't know a lot of things then that we know today. And it put many bishops in a rough spot. But there are many factors at work which might explain their support of this so-called revolution or just their total neutrality. The first is the lying media using their myths about Rasputin to discredit the old state. The honest belief that there was an actual abdication and Nicholas commanded all of this, therefore we follow the Tsar. The belief that Nicholas commanded obedience to the Masonic state, which is absurd. That the elected assembly should come next, would elect a new monarch in the near future. or even that the abdication was only temporary, and Nicholas would return. Importantly, there was a total lack of knowledge about leftist ideology and what they really wanted for the world. They believed that Rasputin's power in the Kremlin was real. It was not. People were getting conflicting information, sometimes none at all. Yes, left were lying about their intentions and their agenda. And keep in mind what year this is. We're talking about 1917. The entire population had PTSD. Millions had been killed by this point. The reaction, you could see this in the local chronicle of Optina. On March 6, 1917, noon in Vlam, this is actually Vlam, not Optina, we received the sad news, the coup in Russia and the abdication of the Tsar. The first impression and the last news, a feeling of orphanhood for Holy Russia is unthinkable without the monarchy. From that day, we lost all hope of the victorious outcome of the war. As much as we were confident of victory before the coup, so much did we lose all confidence after the fall of Tsarist power, which now has passed to the hands of persons who do not meet their importance and people's trust. Well, obviously, from the first days of Soviet rule, the monastery was under close scrutiny. Cheka, Agpu, NKVD, they were always doing undercover operations against the monastics. January 23, 1918, a decree from the Council of People's Commissars closed the monastery. Now, they went underground. They kind of called themselves an agricultural cooperative. But in 1923, even that was closed. And the monastery was, it came under the main directorate of science. Then it was named the Optina Putin Museum, which actually still exists. A holiday home was open there for party members. Then that was turned, on orders of Beria, into a concentration camp, Kozlesk 1. And that's where about 5,000 Polish officers were housed, 4,400 of whom were sent to Katyn for execution. But yeah, that's how we know that the Germans didn't do it. It was a hospital in World War II, a screening infiltration camp for the NKVD for Soviet officers returning from captivity. And after the war, until 1949, a military unit was stationed there. But in the beginning, arrests started in 1919, continued into 1920. Brethren's cells were searched. They were charged with nothing less than preparing a military conspiracy against the new government. The monastery leadership, senior brethren, continued right up until 1923. These were for intimidation before anything else. Lydia Zatschuk, who was a former director of the Putin Museum, says that she was arrested 18 times in this period of time. Then they deported the monastics to their places of origin. And they accused them of counter-revolutionary agitation. The state got serious in 1927, following the Ogpu investigation. People arrested included here a monk, Nikon Belayev, who was the de facto spiritual father of the monks, several others. The Soviets sometimes, something is termed the minus six condition. Minus six refers to the fact that exile means you can't live in the six major regions of the country. You have to go where there's nobody. Over the next 3 years, all churches in the area were shut down. Ogpu said there was about 40 monastics at Optina then. And then 1930, there was another wave. That was started because there was an uprising of peasants. Remember, the peasant uprisings were endless after the revolution. The state action was so outrageous against churches, against everyone else. And the monks, all 40 of them, were accused of preparing this uprising and counter-revolutionary agitation, which is probably true. And they were arrested and sentenced to various terms of imprisonment or exile in the minus six. Again, it's not the first time. 18th century, the state under Peter has stolen everything. 1704, by a decree of Peter the Great, Optina was required to pay a huge rent to pay for the construction of St. Petersburg and the war against the Swedes. They had to appeal to their contributors to continue to function. It was reduced to 12 members in 1724. It was abolished in 1724 by the spiritual regulations. It was annexed to the Belov Monastery. Archbishop Leonid of Sarsk and Podolsk to the Archimandrite of the of that monastery, supposed to be annexed to, gave the property back. Things changed, and I think, despite the persecutions in the 18th century, the dividing line would be when Metropolitan Platon of Moscow visited the place in 1795. And after that, there was no more direct persecution. But still, at that time, there were only 12 members. And it increased throughout the 19th century. But the mentality was, this is done according to the will of God and for the spiritual benefit of the people, but caused by, among other things, the decay of Orthodoxy, especially among the elites. Many there actually believe the Rasputin nonsense. Someone recorded a conversation with an elder in Optina. It's within the Russian State Archives of Literature and Art. Father Anatoly somehow justified the revolutionaries by saying, and this is a quote from him, "Metropolitan Petrim has been arrested, but after all, an adherent of Rasputin, he interfered with something other than his own business. The elder passionately loves everyone, the Tsar, the people, the new government, but sees a soul in every revolutionary." Well, of course, the Rasputin stuff was utter nonsense. "But do not be frightened," he says. The Tsar was removed. The opinion there was there's going to be another one elected soon. Elder Anatoly said there will be a storm and the Russian ship will be broken. On the August 15th, the synod to elect the patriarch and all that, Optina had their delegates there as well. But the election of the Patriarchate, or the restoration, was really the only good thing that they thought came out of it. Because they were surrounded by a total lack of discipline, not just in society, but in the army. And their chronicle throughout 1917 was awful. They saw the end of the world approaching, or at least when you pull back the restrainer. They like to quote Isaiah 25, or 34, actually, sorry. My sword has drunk its fill in the heavens, etc. Her nobles have nothing there to be called a kingdom. All her princes will vanish away. There'll be nothing left. That was coming. However, it was restored. I'm not entirely sure how many monks are there right now, or if the typical eldership has been restored. I don't know. It's been a slow revival, but at least from the outside, it looks beautiful. And the state, of course, has financed some of this. And it was, you know, when you have people in 1987, near the end of the communist rule within the Communist Party, demanding it be restored, that says something about how things had changed in the 70s and 80s. December 17th of 87 actually was the decree on the reopening. Archimandrite Evlogi Smirnov was the first abbot there. So you have this constant cycle of death and rebirth. But throughout, you have one thing. I mean, even in the Soviet era, you have underground elders. Do they exist today? I'm not going to say either way. Obviously, I think some exist. Maybe even in this country, I'm not mentioning any names. People who have this tremendous participation in the will of God, they could see right through you. I'm not going to mention anybody, but they're very, very few. The minute someone says they're an elder, you know that they're not. False eldership is a problem, of course. But they have to show you that they're a false elder. Anyway, I've gone way over my time here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.